Hello and welcome back to the 3 a.m. Mystery Club. I'm Derek, joined by my co-host Rowena. We are captainless tonight. Brandon got held up by his day job and is taking a little break this evening. So please join Rowena. She has a case for us tonight. I'm ready if you are.
Okay, I'm really excited about this case. A very close friend of mine, Sarah, suggested this to me. She actually gave me a list of more international unsolved mysteries. I think I sent you one maybe, or I thought about sending you one, because when I looked at just a few little headlines from it, I was like, oh, that's a Derek one.
I don't remember. If you did, I don't know why I don't remember.
Well, it's been a few weeks now, so.
Oh, okay.
Who knows? It probably got lost in our chat stream.
We send so many random things to each other every second of the day. I'm sure I saw it and just forgot already.
So the case I chose is an old one, because if you know me by now, you know I like the really old cases. And I like the ones that have more of a sensational, tabloid, soapy kind of slant. And also a little show note, we are going to be taking a small hiatus after this. We have been recording faithfully, what is it, 2 episodes a week now since December 2020?
Yes, since December.
Yeah, so just like any good show or TV show, I think we kind of deserve a little tiny break, don't you, Derek?
I think so. And plus, it's not just to give us a break. It's so we can regroup and really get to work on our next cases that we're going to be doing and make sure we find quality stories that our listeners will appreciate and enjoy.
Right. Because we really like to take the time and research into this stuff. And we don't want to give you the same content that everybody else does. We want to always try to find a new slant on it. And so taking a little break gives us time to do that. So we hope you guys will be patient with us and maybe even get caught up on our older episodes.
There's definitely a lot of content to sift through. As you said, we have been recording faithfully since December. So if you haven't checked out all of our episodes, we would really love it and be so grateful if you did. And please, of course, let us know what you think on social media.
And if you're catching up on our episodes, go ahead and hit that like, subscribe, and comment on your favorite podcast platform.
Ready to take it away?
I am. So tonight's episode, brought to you by my friend Sarah Hunley and presented by me. And I'm going to apologize ahead of time because I'm going to try to say these German names as colloquially as possible. But if I butcher it, it's not intentional. And I just want to put that out there because odds are I will butcher them. So tonight's case is called the Hinterkaifeck Murders. Are you familiar with this case, Derek?
Not at all. And I don't think I would forget that name.
Well, so this case takes place in 1922 in a small farmstead in Germany. The actual name of the farm is Hinterkaifeck. It is now called, or the area that the farm was in is now called Wadafin. Like I said, there's going to be a lot of words that I'm going to throw at you tonight.
I just have to say something. It's Hinterkaifeck.
Yes.
That sounds like a roller coaster at an amusement park in America.
It really does. Like, I could see this at Kings Island or Cedar Point.
Totally.
Back when Kings Island served beer.
Yes. definitely would have been near the beer garden.
Definitely. Do you think it would be a water ride roller coaster? Like those ones that, you know, do the deep drops really fast and go into water, or would it be a spinner?
I imagine it being a normal steel coaster, but doing a deep drop where it looks like you're going to go into the water of the beer garden.
Yes, yes, definitely. We need to design our own theme park. Let's put a pin in that one for later.
That sounds amazing, but given my fascination with amusement park morbid stuff, I don't think my brain would allow me to do that.
Maybe you could be the safety director.
Perfect.
Okay, so here we go with the Hendrik Hyphak murders. So on the night of March 31st, 1922, which was a Friday, that's very important, one of the most infamous unsolved family annihilations in German history took place. In a small town in rural Germany, on the Hendrik Hyphak farm, patriarch Andreas Gruber, his wife Kaisila, their widowed daughter Victoria Gabrielle, her young children, Kaisila Jr., she was named after her grandmother, and Josef, and their maid, Maria Baumgartner, were struck dead with a pickaxe, or a mattock would be the term of the day. The bodies were not found for nearly a week, because once the killer had done his heinous deed, he made himself at home and lived among the family for days. The local villagers didn't notice it. Yeah.
What?
Yeah, yeah. This case, just wait, Derek. It gets so much darker and so much crazier.
I apologize for the delay. As you know, I was on mute because my pug is walking around clicking her toenails on the floor. But this person lived with them for days?
Yes. Yes. It's to the point that the reason the people didn't notice anything was amiss is because they saw smoke coming from the chimney. The livestock on the farm seemed to be fed and well looked after, and the family dog was running in and out of the house as he normally did.
How bizarre.
Yeah.
What is it with these courteous psychos that have manners?
I know. So the local villagers didn't notice anything was amiss at first. Like I said before, they saw smoke coming from the chimney in the home. The livestock animals were being fed, and even the family dog was being let out from time to time. What they would discover 4 days after the murder would once again be ranked as one of Germany's most gruesome unsolved crimes. So because this case, as we get into it, has so many side notes and twists and turns, I'm going to start off with a timeline. So hopefully that keeps it clear for everybody out there. So on March 31st, which was a Friday, on the afternoon of March 31st, 1922, the new maid, Maria Baumgartner, arrived at the farm. Maria's sister had escorted her there and left the farm after a short stay. She was most likely the last person to see the inhabitants alive. It appears that in the late evening, Victoria Gabrielle, her 7-year-old daughter, Kaisila, and her parents, Andreas and Kaisila Sr., were lured to the family barn through the stable where they were murdered one at a time. The perpetrator used a mattock, as I said before, which is a pickaxe, belonging to the family farm, and killed the family with blows to the head. The perpetrator moved into the living quarters, where, with the same murder weapon, he killed baby Josef sleeping in his crib and the maid, Baumgartner, in her bed.
This is horrible.
So this lady hadn't even worked there a full day, and she got murdered.
Wow, that is not to make light of it, but that's a horrible first day at work.
Like, you think you have sucky days at work? This lady hadn't even worked there a full 12 hours, I don't think.
And somebody came at her with a pickaxe.
Exactly. So 4 days.
Serious workers' comp.
Really, I know. It's crazy. So in our timeline, so this was on the March 31st. On April 1st, the day after the murders, some coffee merchants. This was back in the days when merchants still went door to door for stuff because it's 1922 in a rural area. So some coffee merchants arrived on the farm to see if an order needed to be placed. When no one responded to knocks on the door and the window, they walked around the yard but found no one. They only noticed that the gate to the machine shed or the, what would we call it, the utility shed was open before they decided to leave. And then this is important too. So this was a Saturday. And in Germany at that time, kids went to school 6 days a week. So Kaizalea was absent without excuse for the next few days of school, and the family failed to show up for Sunday worship. So she was absent Saturday, and then they didn't go to school or Sunday school.
And then all the church people were just like, oh, those bunch of sinners didn't come in today.
Oh, you wait till you hear about all the sins this family does.
Oh, I didn't realize.
Oh, you called it, sis.
I was just trying to be funny.
Oh, no, you called it. So on April 4th, so now we are 4 days. This is the fourth day. On April 4th, a repairman went to Hinterkaifeck to repair the engine of a machine that was broken. He stated that he had not seen any of the family and had heard nothing but the sounds of the farm animals and the dog inside the barn. So after waiting for an hour, he decided to start his repair, which he completed in roughly 4.5 hours. He then went to the neighbor's house to let them know, hey, I haven't seen the family, but I did complete the work. So could you tell them that, you know, I guess maybe so that the bill could get paid or something. I don't know how things worked in 1922, but I would assume that's why he told the neighbors he did the work. So around 3:30 p.m. that same day, the family's neighbor, Lorenz Schlittenbauer, sent his son Johann, 16, and his stepson Josef, 9, to Hinterkaifeck to see if they could make contact with the family, because by now no one had actually seen or spoken with them in days. When they reported that they did not see anyone, Schlittenbauer headed to the farm with two other local residents. Entering the barn, they found the bodies of Andreas, his wife Kaizalea, their daughter Victoria, his granddaughter little Kaizalea, murdered in the barn. Shortly after, they found the maid, Maria, and baby Josef in the home, dead. There's actually online, which I will show you later, there are actual crime scene photos. This is some of the earliest crime scene photos I've ever seen.
Wow, there are crime scene photos from that long ago?
Yes. The earliest I've seen is Jack the Ripper, but this was pretty thorough for the time. So I can't wait to show you that either.
I would have never imagined that.
Yeah, it's crazy. But kudos to the police for thinking to get those photos, because that was still a new technology.
Definitely.
So far what I've told you, this case is pretty bad, but here's where it gets really creepy. I mean, I'm getting tingles getting ready to tell you this. So the maid, Maria Baumgartner, had started working for the Gruber family on the day of the murders and was also murdered. She replaced a former maid who had quit 6 months prior because she heard footsteps in the attic and strange voices. She insisted the home was haunted and quit.
That is creepy as hell.
Yeah. So, it gets creepier. A few other coincidences also occurred leading up to the murders. Andreas found a strange newspaper from Munich, which was the closest city, on the property sometime in March of 1922. He could not remember buying the paper and believed the postman had brought it there by mistake. This was not the case, however, as no one in the vicinity subscribed to that particular paper. Back then, you know, newspapers were the most important source to get your news of the day. And in rural areas, you usually relied on your local paper, and it didn't make sense to get a big city paper bust in. Like your news would be really old. And also the population was so spread out. You knew who subscribed to what, because oftentimes you would, you know, share it. Like if I had a People magazine and you had an In Touch Weekly, and we traded, kind of that kind of deal.
Swap gossip mags.
Yeah, pretty much. So nobody in the in that vicinity subscribed to a Munich paper, which was odd that he would just find it on his property. And then also days before the murders, Gruber told neighbors he discovered tracks in the fresh snow that led from the forest to a broken door lock in the farm's tool shed. a set of house keys had also gone missing. Later, during the night, they heard footsteps in the attic, but Gruber found no one when he searched the building. Although he told several people about these observations, he refused to accept help, and the details went unreported to the police.
This is giving me vibes of that story Brandon did about that person that lived in the house.
Yeah, Daniel LaPlante.
Yes.
I know, that's what I thought as I read this too. This was like the OG LaPlante guy. So after the bodies were discovered, local police sought the aid of inspectors from the big city of Munich. Initial investigations were hampered by the number of people who had interacted with the crime scene. So on the day the bodies were found, the local yokels, as I like to call them, hampered with the crime scene. Like, Maria was in her nightgown because she'd been murdered in her sleep. They dressed her. And some of the documentaries I saw, and in some of the things I read, they actually put clothes on her so that to protect her modesty. One of the neighbors, which I'll get into more detail later in this case, because it's important. So when they found the bodies initially in the barn, they were stacked on top of each other like a tower and covered in hay. Well, when the neighbor found them, he started unstacking them. So all that initial evidence they could have collected was contaminated. He then also, it was reported that the villagers that were coming in were stomping through the crime scene, actually started eating the food and offering food to the police from the kitchen of the Gruber's home.
This is so odd.
Like while the body of the maid and the baby were still in the house, they're like, oh, would you like a sandwich?
How strange.
Yeah. And so the day after the discovery of the bodies, a physician performed the autopsies in the barn. It was established that a mattock or a pickaxe was the most likely murder weapon. The weapon itself was not immediately found at the scene. Evidence also showed, and this is really sad, that the younger Kaizilia, the 7-year-old, had been alive for several hours after the assault. And this was evidenced because she had torn her hair out in tufts from her scalp while laying in the straw, which means that she was aware of what was going on and she was pulling her hair out because she was scared, is what the coroner assumed.
This is horrible.
Yeah. So the police first suspected the motive to be robbery, and they interrogated traveling craftsmen, vagrants, and several inhabitants from surrounding villages. But a large amount of money was found untouched in the home, and also all their valuables were left intact. And then the livestock itself back then is a commodity, and none of them were harmed or stolen.
This is very weird and making me wonder if it was a family member with some sort of revenge thing.
Yeah, yeah. And we're going to get into that here in a minute. So it was clear the perpetrators had remained at the farm for several days. Someone had fed the cattle, eaten the entire week's supply of bread from the kitchen, and had recently cut up meat from the pantry. This was prior to the villagers doing it. No money or valuables were taken. And in some of the reports I read, when they went up into the attic, they found breadcrumbs and they found evidence of people living there. Like, this is really gross, but I want to say a slop bucket, but more like a chamber pot that had been used up there. Like, like they basically were pooping in a bucket up there and they left it. So like they knew somebody was hiding in the house.
Oh, the things we talk about.
I know. And I said slop bucket first thing.
And that got me laughing. And then you said pooping in a bucket and that made it worse.
So the case was officially closed in 1955. While no arrests have been made, there have been a number of suspects. Two of the most popular suspects, according to fellow armchair detectives online, are Carl Gabriel. Now, Carl was the husband of Victoria, Carl had reportedly been killed in France by a shell attack in December 1914 during the First World War. However, his body had never been recovered. After the murders, people began to speculate if he had indeed died in the war. Victoria Gabrielle had given birth to Joseph illegitimately in her husband's absence. Theorists surmised that Carl did not die in the war, and upon making his way home, discovered his wife with an extra child, Joseph, born after he had went to war, so he could not have been the father.
You are not the father.
Where's Mari when you need him?
Seriously.
So the theory is that Carl, suffering from shell shock, which is now known as PTSD, became enraged at his wife's infidelity, and instead of revealing himself to the family, he hid in the attic in nearby woods until he finally snapped in jealousy and killed the entire family out of revenge. So that's one popular theory. And the next one, which is almost everywhere you look, this is the person they have pegged as the guy, is the neighbor, Lawrence Schlittenbauer. Again, excuse me if I butchered that, which I'm pretty sure I did. And this is where your theory comes into play, Derek. So shortly after the death of his first wife in 1918, Lawrence Schlittenbauer was believed to have a relationship with Victoria Gabrielle and Father Joseph. Schlittenbauer came under suspicion by locals early in the investigation because of his several suspicious actions immediately after the discovery of the bodies. When Schlittenbauer and his friends came to investigate, they had to break a gate to enter the barn because all of the doors were locked. However, immediately after finding the bodies in the barn, Schlittenbauer apparently unlocked the front door with a key. Now, remember, a set of keys to the house had gone missing several days before the murders. So it's also possible that as a neighbor, you know, the Grubers had given him keys, or as Victoria's lover, she might have given him some keys. But that does sound sus to me. When asked by his companions why he had gone into the house alone when it was unclear if the murderer might still be there, Schlittenbauer allegedly stated that he went to look for his son, Joseph. Regardless of any of the above rumor, it is known that Schlittenbauer had disturbed the bodies at the scene, compromising the investigation. Another reason to suspect Lorenz is the rocky relationship he had with Victoria and her father, Andreas, surrounding the parentage of baby Joseph. Now buckle your seatbelt for this one, Derek.
Buckled.
So we are getting ready to transfer from Mari to Jerry Springer.
Okay.
Through the years, rumors swirled around the area that Andreas, the father of Victoria, had an incestuous relationship with his daughter, Victoria. To substantiate these rumors, in 1915, Andreas was sentenced to a year imprisonment for the crime of incest. His daughter was sentenced to a month for the same offense. We don't know whether it was consensual or not, but Andreas has been described as a miserly, controlling, ill-tempered, and abusive in reports from town locals at the time. So you can draw your own conclusions based on that if you like.
Right. It sounds a little... the picture is being painted.
Yes. So it is also claimed that as a result of their continued incestuous affair, that Andreas was the actual father of his own grandchild, Joseph. Although Lawrence Schlittenbauer was named on the child's birth certificate, several times Lawrence publicly claimed he wasn't the father and that the child was Andreas's. This led to Andreas threatening Schlittenbauer with legal action. The threat seemed not to work as Lorenz took the step of reporting the crime for a second time. After being reported, Andreas and Victoria again faced prosecution for the offense. However, they were both acquitted in the second instance. This was after Schlittenbauer took back his claims about the paternity of Joseph. He now said he was the child's father. Rumors suggest that Victoria may have promised to marry Lorenz and drop the paternity suit, like child support, if the charges were dropped.
Wow, this really took a Jerry Springer turn. Where is Steve when you need him?
Right. So, and I, you know, as we do, we go on a lot of different places to get our information. On I found a really good Reddit post, a poster by the name of Novantigone surmised this theory in the best terms. She quote says, now, Lorenz's wife died in 1918, and in that same year, between the months of August and December, Lorenz and Victoria had an intimate relationship with each other. It was in 1919 that Victoria gave birth to her son, Joseph. She claimed that Lorenz was the father. At the time, Lorenz agreed with these claims, and he once even said that he wanted to marry Victoria, but that her father absolutely would not allow that to happen. At other times, Lorenz was one of a few people who actively spread the rumors around the nearby villages that Joseph was actually the product of incest and that his father was actually his grandfather. Not long before the murders took place, Victoria had told Lorenz that she was going to sue him for money for their son. It is reported that Lorenz was quite upset about this because overall, the Gruber-Gabriels family were more well off than the other families nearby. And though Lorenz wasn't doing poorly, he was still wasn't as well off as Victoria's family. So he was upset that she would sue him for money that she didn't need for a child that he at times claimed was actually her father's. To further the idea that Lorenz may have committed or been involved in some part of the murders, we should take into consideration that he was in fact one of the people who discovered the bodies. When the neighbors found the first four bodies in the barn, they had been stacked. Lorenz immediately began unstacking them. And when asked why he was touching them, he claimed that he was looking for Joseph. It was after Lorenz did not find Joseph in the barn that they all went into the house where they discovered the last two bodies. Lorenz had been known to claim that Joseph was not his son, but was Andreas's son. Was he actually worried about Joseph, or was he trying to cover his tracks and create a reason as to why he had touched the bodies in case investigators later determined there was evidence of him having been there? Either could be possible, but no solid evidence was ever found against Lorenz, end quote. Now, this Redditor has a really good YouTube video also to back up her theory.
What's that? Because I am just torn on this.
So I will post that in the show notes for everyone to look at.
I don't even know what I think.
So she has a good deep dive on it, and she explains it in simple terms for everybody. And again, I'll post that. And then also, there are a couple other short videos, like BuzzFeed Unsolved has a 5-minute cap about the case, which is good if you don't have a lot of time, but you still are interested. So for many years after, local suspicion remained on Schlittenbauer. According to reports in the files for the case, a local teacher discovered Schlittenbauer visiting the remains of the now demolished Hinterkaifeck in 1925. When asked why he was there, Schlittenbauer said that the perpetrators attempted to bury the family's remains in the barn had been hindered by the frozen ground. This was seen as evidence that Schlittenbauer had intimate knowledge of the conditions of the ground at the time of the murders. Although being a neighbor and a familiar with the local land, he could have been making, you know, an educated guess. Another speculation was that Schlittenbauer murdered the family after Victoria demanded financial support for young Joseph. Before his death in 1941, Schlittenbauer conducted and won several civil claims for slander against persons who described him as the murderer of Hinterkaifeck. Now, no arrests were ever made in the case, and it was officially closed in 1955, but not forgotten. In 1923, the farm was demolished and a memorial shrine was put up where it remains to this day. In 1999, a woman came forward with knowledge of the murder, indicating that her former landlord had information about the killings.
Did you say 1999?
Yeah. Yeah, this case, even though it's closed, things keep popping up. I mean, it's crazy. So officials investigated this tip and learned that the landlord had supposedly also made this claim in 1935. However, it was too late as the potential suspect mentioned in the lead was no longer alive in 1999. Here's the thing about this case. As new things come out in modern times, German officials are so tight-lipped about witnesses and suspects. I mean, they know how to keep a secret. Like, I don't know who the name of the person who made this claim. We don't know who the suspect was. Like, they don't they will not mention that because they of the chance, slight chance that there might be some relatives alive, and they don't want to cause any trouble for any relatives, if that makes sense.
Well, they're thorough.
Yeah. So in 2007, more than 80 years after the Gruber family and their maid were killed, students at a German police academy used modern techniques to investigate the unsolved case. The students ruled out all but one suspect they believed to have committed the murders. However, the suspected killer is dead, so they didn't publicly name the person they think is responsible for the massacre out of respect for that suspect's relatives who are still alive. And they are keeping a tight lid on that information, as I said earlier. Because I scoured the internet for hours and hours and could not find any details. And before I close up this case, I have one more fact about this case, and it's a doozy. Like, it tops everything.
What's that?
Once the autopsies were complete, the heads of all six victims, as I said earlier, were sent to Munich for further study. It turns out the further study involved seeking the assistance of city psychics to gain information. No useful information was provided, and the heads were subsequently lost in the chaos of World War II, which means that the victims of Hinterkaifeck were buried minus a body part, and their heads have never been found.
I can't believe all of these gruesome cases from so long ago. There have been crazy people from the beginning of time.
Yes. And so that leaves us with so many questions. Why was this family targeted? Did someone want revenge over a perceived slight? Was Andreas so disliked by the community for his Scrooge persona and the abuse of his daughter that a vigilante decided to rid the village of the entire family? Was it someone they knew? We may never know.
Like, did they have an Aunt Betty or an Aunt Thelma that was jealous of all their livestock or what?
See, they thought in some of my research, so Andreas had a brother who inherited the farm. And for a little while, he was suspected maybe he did it because their farm was really prosperous and they were one of the wealthier families in the area. But he turned around and sold it to Victoria's in-laws. Oh, like almost immediately after pressure from the village, he wanted to keep farming and the village was like, no, terrible things happened here. It's no good. We don't want to remember that. So he then sold it at a loss, from my understanding, to Victoria's in-laws, the Gabrielle family, who then demolished everything and put up a memorial. So he was pretty quickly cleared.
I wish I had like concrete theories that I could throw out, but it's got to be some old timey perceived slight, I think.
And it's crazy, isn't it?
Like, I was kind of half joking about the livestock jealousy just because I wanted to say Aunt Thelma, but seriously, I feel like it could have been something like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, I don't even know.
And then the incest angle is something right to be looked at.
I know, and then there was some theory, but that Andreas had killed the family because he was already rumored to be an abusive person, a controlling person, and that he may have found out that Victoria was going to drop the paternity suit to get the incest charges dropped or something, and it made him angry, and he just killed everybody. But then at the same time, how could he have pickaxed himself in the face?
Right. That right there, him pickaxing himself in the face, is what makes that theory not add up for me.
Right. So, and then there are a couple of instances of like drifters, because it was a rural area and it was on the way to Munich, the biggest city in the area.
That makes sense, like somebody passing through on the way to the city. And that theory would also, at least for me, explain why the person maybe lived in the house. They had a place to stay.
Right, right. So my theory is either it was Schlittenbauer or it was a grifter.
I'm thinking one of those sounds likely as well. it's just fascinating to me that this is such an old case, like very old. And then 1999, there's information. 2007, there's information. Like, how is there still information coming out from right. so long ago when so many of them have to be dead already?
Right. That's crazy. And I do think it's neat that they're actively like letting police academy students try to figure out this case and that they've got it down to one suspect now. Because when the case was initially investigated, they had over 100 suspects. Like they put everybody on the list.
Oh, I'm looking at these pictures right now that you're showing me. And I can just see the thumbnail for each one. And they're so creepy looking. I mean, from what I can see, because I mentioned I'm seeing the thumbnail, these are pretty impressive photos to be so old.
Right.
Oh, I mean, one of them, even from the thumbnail, I can actually see the detail of the bricks and the wall. Spooky feeling about those pictures.
It's just creepy.
Find the best old cases. This is a Rowena, a classic Rowena one for sure.
You know, I try my best. So yeah, that is the Hinterkaifeck murders.
Well, thank you so much for that. That was really fascinating and gruesome. I had that poor baby, and I think about that maid with her first day at work.
I know, like when you start a new job and you think this is the worst job ever, just think about Maria Baumgartner.
I'll remember, and I wish we had Brandon here to discuss this because I can imagine his commentary.
I can too. Like this could be, and Brandon, if you want to chime in on your own later when you're editing this, please do.
Yeah, please.